This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Dogs have long been called man's best friend. Today, we highlight a statewide prison program, New Leash on Life, aimed at training dogs for adoption and giving minimum and medium custody state prisoners a chance to turn their life around. In June, I visited Craven Correctional Institution in Vanceboro, where the program has been going strong for a decade. Walking through a maze of hallways and locked doors, program director for the New Leash on Life program at Craven Correctional Institution, Brenda Malenga, leads me to a building located in the interior of the prison. A guard unlocks a door leading to an outside courtyard. Here, four inmates are standing with their leash dogs, practicing basic commands like sit, stay, and lay down. Our presence seems to break the dog's concentration.
For 8 weeks, that's pretty much what we do, is it's just all obedience training, it's just all repetition. One thing we do not do is we do not treat train here. It's done by repetition and praise and affection. That's pretty much it.
Inmates who apply to participate in the New Leash on Life program teach their dog basic obedience with an emphasis on house training and socialization. Inmate Dwayne Futrell has been working with Luna for 7 weeks.
She's a 2-year-old border collie corgi cross. She's very lovable, energetic. We've done some search stuff with her, just hiding stuff. She's really good at that. She loves playing ball.
He says training takes time, patience, and persistence.
Our sit stays and down stays consist, we started at like 30 seconds and we moved them up to 15 minutes a time now. So they're sitting in 15 minute increments for a down stay and a sit stay. We do equal play, like if we work for 40 minutes, we give them 40 minutes worth of play. It's an equal thing, you know, they need both the same amount of exercise as they do training.
Local animal shelters are key in identifying dogs to participate in the program. So far, more than 215 have been trained at Craven Correctional. Futrell says it's hard work caring for a dog, but the companionship is more than worth the challenge.
It's not only a job of you taking care of yourself, you have to take care of them, their well-being. So therefore, being with them helps you just an all-around better person. I couldn't see doing it without the dogs.
Inmates in the program start the day at 7 o'clock and lead the dogs out of their crates. They do some indoor house training and then go outside to work with Drake Parker, a trainer from Top Dog Academy. He volunteers to teach the inmates how to train their dogs.
Dogs can be a bridge back to everybody else, a bridge back to society is kind of how we look at it. In fact, our motto is better men, one dog at a time. You know, sometimes you got to do something, not because you're getting paid for it, not because you're getting something out of it, but just because it's the right thing to do.
Program inmates spend the rest of the day with their dogs by their side. Around 7 p.m., the dogs are crated until the next morning. Superintendent Four at Craven Correctional Institution, Larry Dale, says the 12-hour training day is beneficial for inmates.
They learn responsibility, and then that branches off into the inmates being able to take community college classes in veterinary assistant tech programs, being certified dog trainers. So it's just a win-win situation for inmates, for staff, and for the general public.
Craven Community College offers a 120-credit-hour vet tech course at the prison where inmates can learn the skills necessary to get a job at a veterinarian's office or an animal shelter when they are released back into society. The North Carolina Department of Labor also offers inmates an apprenticeship certification, which can help them land a job. Malenga says most inmates decide to stick with the program because they have to complete 4,000 hours of on-the-job training and a total of 288 hours of related instruction to get the certification.
When the guys become the primary trainers, they usually, unless they get shipped out, you know, they make minimum custody or something like that, most of the time they'll stay primary trainers for at least 2 or 3 years.
Inmate Ruben Vargas has been involved with the New Leash on Life program for 2 years. He's training Katie, a mixed mutt.
Man, she's a very lovable dog. She's a little stubborn. You know what I mean? But I had worse than her, you know what I mean? She plays with the other dogs. She loves people.
Vargas completed his vet tech class and is currently working on his GED. He says training dogs has taught him responsibility and determination.
The dogs is not, that's the easy part, you know? Dealing with people, you know, is one of the challenging things, you know what I'm saying? It's something I love doing, man, you know? And I have plans. This is what I really want to do when I get out, you know what I mean? I might give it a shot, man.
The new Leash on Life program is about second chances. The dogs get a new home, and the inmates have an opportunity to turn their lives around. Luna's human, inmate Dwayne Futrell, has been at the prison for 3 months, and so far he's already completed his vet tech class and is working to get his apprentice certification from the State Department of Labor. He also wants to pursue a career working with dogs when he gets out of prison.
It just gives me something, you know, to show the community that I can better myself and I can do something back and give back to the community instead of messing up like I've done in my life. I can actually turn around and show people what good I can do instead of what bad I can do.
More than 215 dogs trained at Craven Correctional have been adopted since the new Leash on Life program started in 2004. Program Director Brenda Malinga says they've had great success finding homes for the dogs.
We've only had one dog that hasn't been adopted. We're in the process back and forth with her of getting her adopted. The rest of the dogs normally, by the time graduation comes around, in all other cases, they've all been adopted. So we've been really lucky.
Since my visit last month, inmate Ruben Vargas has received his apprenticeship certificate from the North Carolina State Labor Department in dog training. Additionally, two more trainers have completed requirements to receive their certifications. The 8-week course that ended July 10th saw four dogs, Katie, Stella, Bud, and Luna, complete the new Leash on Life training. Malinga says so far, three of the four dogs have found new homes, except for 2-year-old Luna. New Leash on Life is a program held across the state. It was announced this week that Eastern Correctional Institution in Greene County is closing as a men's prison and will be converted into a minimum security women's prison. There are currently four dogs there that have been training for about 3 weeks. All of them are healthy, heartworm negative, spayed or neutered, and current on vaccinations. The dogs need to be adopted by the end of August. If you're interested in adopting Luna or any of the dogs trained through the New Leash on Life program, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. Cities and towns across eastern North Carolina are beginning to view their rivers as a source of recreation and revenue, and Greenville is no exception. Today, Lee Jenkins tells us about the Tar River Legacy Plan.
Sleepily creeping through Pitt and Beaufort counties, the Tar River stretches from Louisville, North Carolina, to the Pamlico Sound. The river was originally named for the tar-laden barges that used it as a bustling shipping lane. Nowadays, there's not much happening on the 7-mile stretch of the river that flows through Greenville. City planner LaMarco Morrison half-jokingly says some residents and tourists don't even know Greenville has a river. Morrison hopes the Tar River Legacy Plan will change that.
Many people aren't aware that there's a river until they cross the two bridges we have. The Tar River Legacy Plan will lend us some ideas on ways we can better utilize the river, short-term, mid-term, and long-term.
Project officials have been drafting the plan alongside ordinary citizens through public meetings since March. Project officials now have approved a master plan, which will be presented to the city and budgeted in September. That meeting will determine how many phases of the plan will be implemented and how much funding will be allocated to the project. According to Morrison, the proposed projects range from basic landscaping to establishing residential and recreational centers.
Some of the less costly projects we can do immediately within the next 1 to 2 years. And then there are larger projects that deal with, you know, large-scale development, mixed-use, housing, recreation, parks, and things of that nature that are more long-term, 5 to 10 years.
Potential amenities include attractions like a riverside BMX park, an extreme sports park for skating and skateboarding, an adventure park featuring a series of suspended platforms, zip lines, and other above-ground activities and obstacles, rural camping platforms for endurance kayakers and other intrepid outdoorsmen to stay the night, and eventually retail outlets and restaurants. Walking paths will be cleared and maintained as well, allowing the truly adventurous to travel from one attraction to another on foot. The project is partly intended to attract residents to the city and keep them there, counteracting the brain drain college towns like Greenville tend to suffer from.
We have a lot of young professionals that start out, you know, at East Carolina, and some even go on to work at the hospital, but research have shown that we're having a hard time retaining these people. And so we think that a large part of the economic development would be to retain young people, young families, you know, young graduates from East Carolina.
Morrison expects the project will go beyond giving Greenville homeowners a reason to stick around.
Certainly we're looking at a regional draw. you know, we think some of these amenities like the Adventure Park will attract people from different parts of the state and even South Carolina and Virginia.
The Tar River Legacy Plan shares some similarities with Kinston's 2013 Riverwalk project, which aims to stimulate economic development by connecting its two recreational centers, the Woodman Community Center and Pearson Park, with an elaborate 2.4-mile stretch of riverside parks and walkways. Morrison says the scope and time frame of the two projects vary significantly.
Kinston's Riverwalk project is, to my understanding, is an uptown project. We do look heavily at uptown Greenville and the urban core, but we also look at some of the more rural sections along the river. I think that would be the difference. And we're also looking at other regional areas. We're looking at ways that we could enhance places like Falkland, Tarboro, and even down to Washington. We're looking at ways that we could bring attention to those areas as well.
Kinston's project is further along in its development, having access to $1.2 million in funding. Construction has yet to begin for either project. On the current timelines, Eastern North Carolina residents should be able to enjoy the benefits of both projects within the next 5 years. For Public Radio East, I'm Lee Jenkins.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with the Richard Chapman Cleave Fund of the North Carolina Community Foundation. The public is being asked for its input as a state agency continues the task of managing the reemergence of a bird whose numbers had dwindled severely by the 1970s. George Olson has more.
Jonathan Shaw started as a District 2 wildlife biologist for the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission in 2005. At that time, the commission's turkey biologist was soon to retire, and he was hoping to go out by meeting a particular goal.
One of his goals before he retired was to see the harvest break the 10,000 bird mark. And I believe he retired in 2006, and it had broken the 10,000 bird mark that year. And this past year, 2013, we had a record harvest of 18,000 birds, so it's almost doubled from 2005, 2006 to what it is now.
Hunters pulled in 18,000 wild turkeys last year, a number that would have wiped out the entire turkey population in the state of the early 1970s several times over.
The low point of turkeys in North Carolina was around 1970. We estimate we had approximately 2,000 birds at that time. Wild turkey restoration efforts really began in earnest in the 80s and through the 90s. Early 2000s. Populations quickly grew over that time period. Today we estimate we have approximately 260,000 turkeys across the state.
Evan Stanford, a surveys and research biologist for the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. He says the decline to the record low is something that had been ongoing from the turn of the century and the cause the typical things you hear when discussing a species decline.
The factors that really led to the decreases in turkey population were primarily driven, one, by habitat quality. We just had large-scale degradation of habitat through harvesting of timber and conversion of timberlands to agricultural lands, which really degraded the habitat quality. At the same time, we also had very liberal turkey seasons within our state that allowed the over-harvesting of turkeys. So that's really what led to the decreases in the turkey population that we saw.
Proper management has brought the turkey back to all 100 counties in North Carolina. Turkeys from comparatively well-populated regions were captured and moved to habitat devoid of a turkey population. And now there's a tightly regulated hunting season, essentially early April until mid-May, with a one bird per day limit, male turkey or anything with a beard, two bird max for the season per hunter. Wildlife Resources is also working with landowners who want to encourage an expanding turkey and other wildlife population. Jonathan Shaw.
The greatest benefit, I would say, is to prescribe fire. Putting fire on the ground enhances habitat for turkey, and it also benefits a great number of other wildlife species. Opening up the understory, promoting plant growth on the forest floor, those sorts of things will increase the vegetation and bugging places for turkey and other wildlife species.
To better understand management of the turkey population, the Wildlife Resources Commission has been doing an annual summer turkey observation survey. This year marks the 26th survey, which has generally relied on information from the National Wild Turkey Federation, sportsmen, habitat landowners, and state and federal workers for the data from the survey. This year, the Wildlife Resources Commission is reaching out beyond those groups. Evan Stanford.
this is the first time that we've really attempted to reach out to the public and just do a general news release and put access to the survey on our agency website. And the objective there is to just try to increase overall participation. Overall participation really has been up here in recent years, so we feel that we've been able to capture good data with the survey, but we're just trying to reach out to other members of the public that may have an interest in wild turkeys to even greater strengthen the results of the survey and give us better information to help manage our turkey resource.
That public information can be submitted via a Wildlife Resources Commission webpage. Info from the coastal region might be of particular interest to turkey researchers. Stanford says the coastal plain was the last spot for turkey relocation, as biologists decades ago weren't sure the coast would be hospitable to a resurrection of the turkey population. So while turkey recovery might be considered complete in the western two-thirds of the state, the coastal plain is still on the rebound.
We still have areas on the coastal plain where turkeys are filling in suitable habitat. They have saturated all the landscape on the coastal plain, so we still have expanding populations in many areas, and we still have increasing turkey populations on the coastal plain area, whereas in many of the Piedmont and mountain regions, they've had saturated populations for a long time, and populations are relatively stable there, but actually we still have growing populations in many coastal plain areas.
The survey is currently underway and runs through the end of August. I'm George Olson.
This week, a statewide traveling exhibit called Freedom for All went on display at a plantation in Washington County. The exhibit includes illustrated panels which tell the story of slavery in North Carolina before, during, and after the Civil War. Freedom for All will be on display at the Somerset Place State Historic Site in Creswell until August 23rd. Built in the 1780s, the plantation was one of the largest in the South during the antebellum era. It started as a business venture for three Edenton men in 1785 to grow rice. This week, I spoke with Assistant Site Manager Amber Satterswaite about the exhibit and the history of Somerset Place.
6,000 acres were cleared and cultivated by slaves who dug over 50 miles of canals and 80 miles of ditches here. This was a working plantation for 80 years, from 1785 until 1865, when the Union victory in the Civil War effectively ended slavery.
Now, at one time around the end of the Civil War, Somerset Place was one of the Upper South's largest plantations. Was this in terms of how many slaves worked at the plantation, or maybe the number of acres of land, or the number of structures?
There are a lot of factors that historians use to evaluate the size of a plantation, but a large number of slaves is definitely one of the most defining characteristics of a large planter estate. By 1860, there were about 2,500 people in the South who owned more than 100 enslaved people. Somerset Place was one of only four plantations in North Carolina that had more than 300 slaves living on one property. And over the course of its 80-year lifespan, Somerset Place housed more than 860 slaves.
What types of labor did the slaves do at the plantation?
Well, most of them worked planting and harvesting crops. Wheat and corn would become the major crops here. But there were a number of skilled laborers here, like carpenters and joiners, shoemakers, cooks. And some of them had very specialized jobs. There were 25 house and personal servants.
Now, Amber, the Freedom for All exhibit is on display at the Somerset Plantation from now until August 23rd, commemorating the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation 150 years ago. What are some of the components of this traveling exhibition?
Well, the exhibit is a chronological explanation of events leading to the Emancipation Proclamation and its aftermath. So our visitors will see a collection of illustrated panels that reveal how the American Civil War ultimately resulted in freedom for everyone in our country. It begins by explaining the history of slavery in America, which began in the early 1600s. And in 1863, January 1st changed from a day for buying and selling slaves into Emancipation Day.
I understand that the exhibit also includes a transcription from Abraham Lincoln's preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Can you tell us about this feature of the exhibit?
That was a document that was Lincoln's warning to the South that slaves in Confederate states would be declared free by the United States government unless those states returned to the Union by January 1st of 1863. And on January 1st, no states had come back, and so Lincoln signed the final Emancipation Proclamation, and Freedom for All examines some of the differences between those two documents and explains their immediate results. So you might say that the purpose of this exhibit is to explain the process of emancipation.
Now, what happened to Somerset Plantation after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed?
In January 1863 saw the emancipation of about 100 of 3,000 enslaved residents here in Washington County. And this was because many of the slave owners were desperately trying to keep control of their property, and they had transported many of their slaves to other areas where there was not such a union presence. Josiah Collins here at Somerset, his family had left the plantation completely. They had divided up their slaves, and only 66 of them were remaining here. After the war, many of the slaves who had been taken away from Somerset Place by the Collinses came back here. They reunited with their friends and family. And at first, the Collinses tried to save Somerset Place. They tried to create a sharecropping system where the African Americans could rent land for a portion of the crop that they reaped. But that did not work. And by 1870, that's just 5 years after the war was over, almost all of the former slaves had left Somerset Place, and the Collins family didn't even own the property anymore.
Now, Amber, where can people get more information about the Freedom for All exhibit?
They can always visit our website, nchistoricsites.org/Somerset. And we also have some information going up on our Facebook.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. When I was little, I was lucky enough to be able to go out in the backyard, climb a tree, and pick an apple. We actually had one tree that had five different types of apples grafted onto the tree, so I could go at different times of the summer and pick very different apples. Needless to say, some of them did better than others in the microclimate of our yard, but it was still a wonderful thing. I also had a mulberry tree and loved mulberries. We had filbert nuts. Oh, they were wonderful. And grow on relatively small bushes compared to other nut trees, so it was easy for a child to harvest the frilly brown clusters and pull out the nuts, which I could then break open with a hammer. We had grapevines growing along the dog pen. My dad raised English setters and trained them as bird dogs. I remember Mom trying cherry trees, but in coastal Virginia, they just didn't do that well, and they don't do that well here in coastal North Carolina. We never had vegetable gardens, but now that I think about it, it's pretty easy to figure out why. There were five of us children, and my mom always worked at least part-time to help support us, and Dad was always at work as well. So a vegetable garden that requires at least some attention every day, well, that was not a good way to introduce food into our landscape. But those trees and bushes, well, once they were planted and established, they pretty much made it on their own. We didn't have any fancy regimes of spray. My dad would prune the apple trees regularly, always when he was outside doing other things in the yard. So what's all this rambling about? Well, I was thinking today about incorporating food into the landscape and whether or not it's a good idea for most people. And you know what? I guess my childhood prejudiced me. I think it's a wonderful idea, and it doesn't have to be difficult and time-consuming. Start with trees and shrubs that produce fruit and nuts. There's a tree or shrub out there that produces a food crop to fit almost any landscaping need you have. Choose things that don't require a lot of intensive management to keep disease and insects away. I would pick apples over peaches because if you choose the right variety, apples can produce a decent crop without massive amounts of care. Peaches, on the other hand, are susceptible to so many disease and insect problems that they require a more routine maintenance schedule. I'm not saying that apples don't get any diseases or insects, but they're just not as tender and susceptible. Here in coastal North Carolina, think about blueberry bushes and blackberries. Asian persimmons, oh, what beautiful little trees with the most astounding, unusual blossoms and gorgeous orange fruit. Now you also can start incorporating vegetables into your landscape beds. I think it's easy because I'm used to growing vegetables, and I think you'll find it's easy too once you get started. But if you're just dipping your toe into growing food in your landscape, think about starting with trees and shrubs. Give your children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren or even the neighborhood kids memories like mine. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.